the international banking and euro dollar markets. We want to understand the nature of the euro dollar market specifically and how these have grown and developed in London in the post-war period. These are the key markets that represent the background to the euro dollar system. The euro dollar system itself consists of three primary markets. There's an underlying interbank market where banks buy and sell money lent between themselves. There is a euro loan market, which is a syndicated lending market. It has to be dealt with on a group syndication consortia basis because the amounts involved are so large that no one bank wants to take on the credit risk. The key risk is credit risk, that's the risk of counterparty default. But also we have a parallel, what we call a bond market, which is debt issued in the form of a transferable security. A bond is a security, it's not the same as equity. Equity, you own a share in the value of the company on a going concern. With a bond, it's just a debt instrument issued by the company, but it's issued in identical legal form to a share, so it is a security. So you have equity and you have bonds. So we need to understand the background to these markets. What essentially happened is London has been the centre for international finance for almost 300-400 years. All of this is covered in the key introductory document. We'll look at this in terms of the background to the gold market, to the bill of exchange market, to international trade. What then happened is after the First and Second World Wars, America emerges as the most powerful economy in the world, so the dollar becomes the most important currency in the world. But what effectively happens is this. After the post-war period, London will re-emerge as the key international financial centre, principally because although most of the new value, economic worth in the world is produced in America or in American dollars, and we'll talk about the gold markets and the oil markets and how oil is all denominated in dollars, because the dollar becomes the most important international currency, we're going to shift from this gold standard previously, which was tied to sterling and managed by the Bank of England in London. After the Second World War, America will emerge as the most powerful economy in the world, so we're going to adopt an alternative gold exchange standard adopted under the Bretton Woods Treaty in July 1944. Under the Bretton Woods Treaty, we're going to tie the value of the dollar to gold at $35 per ounce, and then we're going to fix the value of all other currencies in the world to the dollar. We don't fix currencies to gold, we fix them to the dollar, and the dollar's fixed to gold. It's called a gold exchange system. That's the model that's created in 1944 under the Bretton Woods Treaty. What's going to then happen is this. Most of the dollars will be produced, or all the dollars originally will come from America. They'll be produced in America within the American economy. But because the American authorities will over-regulate the American system, all of those dollars will be transferred to London. And this is the basis for the euro dollar market. Initially dollars, but then all other currencies in the world. This will transfer valuable assets in the post-war period from America to London, so London effectively re-emerges as an offshore centre for initially dollar debt and then debt in all other currencies in the world. This is the background to the euro-dollar market, and this is the largest, most powerful market in the world. This is where all the governments in the world raise their money. This is where all the largest companies in the world either raise money or deposit and invest money. So we need to look at the euro-dollar system. We need to understand the background to this. There was also a number of other more specific incidents which helped assist this. For example, you'll see in the text there, Brown Shipley, which is a small specialist boutique bank in London, it tried to attract dollar balances from large insurance companies in London. Also, political concerns arose. For example, the United States authorities froze $20 million of gold, which was due to Czechoslovakia. And then there was also a treasury freeze of $62 million belonging to the Egyptian government. So a lot of countries became nervous and concerned about having their dollar deposits in America, in New York, and the power of the American authorities to freeze those or forfeit those. So a lot of countries also moved their dollar balances from New York to London, and this is the background to the system. In terms of regulation, In America, there was two specific controls imposed. We had Regulation D and we had Regulation Q. I refer to them here as well. Regulation D was a form of interest rate ceiling. You could only pay interest up to a certain limit, which I think was around 5% at that time. Regulation Q imposed a reserve requirement. You'll see in the text there. For transactions up to $40 million, specifically it was $40.5 million, you had a 3% reserve, which meant that the banks had to hold a reserve against the lending. Above that, it was a 12% reserve. These regulations were considered draconian to the American banks, so what did the American banks do? They moved their funds to London. The emergence of London as an offshore financial centre for all of this new dealings, all of these new transactions, was encouraged by the Bank of England, and in particular by the then Governor, Lord Cromer, which I refer to again in the text. So what's going to happen is this: in the post-war period, we're going to create an alternative stable currency system which is tied to the dollar. It's a gold exchange standard which will last between 1944 and 1971, when Richard Nixon, the then president, is going to announce in a monthly radio address a new economic package to pay for the cost of the Vietnam War. As part of that, towards the end of his address, he also says, "And we will close the gold window." And what that simply meant was all the other currencies, countries in the world, could no longer exchange their currencies for dollar. Under the Bretton Woods system, the United States government was legally obliged to exchange dollar bills for gold bullion. And what was happening was a number of countries, in particular France under General de Gaulle, was shipping massive amounts of dollar bills to America to compel, force the Americans to exchange that for gold. So the American gold reserves were being dissipated, they had the cost of the Vietnam War to absorb, and it just became too expensive for them to manage this system. So Nixon announces the closure of the gold window on 15th August 1971, which moves us into floating exchange rates. The new world that we live in of floating currencies, floating interest rates, all the massive volatility that's associated with that all began in August 1971. So this is then the background to the Eurodollar system. All of the main banks in the world, all of the largest banks, then want to come to London to participate in this new market. So London again emerges as the key international financial centre. There is more American banks in London than there is in Manhattan. There's no more Japanese banks in London than there is in Tokyo. At one point we had over, I think the figure was 532 banks. All of the major banks in the world all want to come to London. And the smaller banks that can't participate and lend directly in this market, they will form what are called consortia. So two smaller, let's say Italian banks or three Spanish banks, they come together, they form a special joint venture just so that they can participate in these large deals. And this market will explode once it starts. You'll see at the top there, the market actually expanded by 20 times during the 1960s, 1970s. What will then happen in the 1970s, 1980s, the syndicated lending market will collapse by a factor of four, but the bond market, the security-based bond market, it will expand by a factor of four. These markets will become the largest, most important, significant banks in the world. Now, all of the banks that are participating in this market, what are their objectives? Clearly, principally, is to generate funds, is to participate in these new earning facilities that are being created. But also, there's a number of other specific objectives which I've referred to in the text here. So we're going to diversify investment banking and their activities. We're going to be involved in underwriting and dealing, generate earnings from surplus funds, acquire international access, experience and reputation, develop linkages with other institutions, including, as we've mentioned, through these consortia banks. These Eurodollar banks, as they were referred to, then become involved in a range of activities, including, you'll see there again, deposit acceptance, exchange dealing, lending, loan rollovers, managing bond and equity issues, arranging placements, sourcing corporate finance, trade finance, portfolio management, lease finance, project financing, and export financing. So the banks that are participating are developing a whole range of new areas of expertise, which will become their own sub-markets in themselves, and we'll be looking at all of those during the course of this class. So these markets become amongst the largest, if not the largest, markets in the world. The key thing is this: they are unregulated, because there is no government or agency large enough to regulate these, so they're basically self-managed, self-controlled, self-regulated. In practice, and we'll be looking at this, what happens is that the major institutions in each market come together. They form a trade association. That trade association then instructs the largest law firms in the world, and they prepare standard documentation in each of these key markets. So how is the market regulated? It's regulated through standard documentation production. It's basically a private law system. Who controls it? Who manages it? The law firms acting for the largest institutions in the world. That's how the system works. That's what we need to understand. So there's also a number of other advantages. The market is, certainly for the bond market, it's a bearer market, which means it's anonymous. It's very fast, it's very powerful, it's unregulated, as we've said. These instruments are negotiable, which means you can acquire perfect title only so long as you're acquiring an asset without any notice and defect in title. So even if a bond was stolen, you can still acquire perfect title so long as you have no notice of the origin of the bond. So there's a whole series of associated private law advantages which makes this market very advantageous, makes this very powerful. The private markets is private law, standard documentation, market associations, no official regulation, cross-border in nature, and then later on it'll be virtual, electronic in nature. And what this also does is it brings together all of the key intermediaries in the world. We've highlighted previously the importance of financial intermediation. What's happening is banks bring together surplus assets in any economy, in any market, in any system, and they redistribute that to deficit areas. That's how we create growth and production and construction in any economy, through the genius, benefit, the value of intermediation. And all that simply happens in this market, we're going to re-intermediate all the surplus assets in the world through the new London centres as they merge. In terms of the technical language and the technical detail, we've got an interbank market which supports the Eurodollar system as a whole. We have the syndicated lending market. We have the euro bond market. In terms of original development, we then had what we call a placement market and a taking market. When you deposit funds in the euro dollar market, you don't call it a bank deposit, you call it a placement, and then when you borrow from another bank, you call it taking. So I refer to that in the text. What's then going to happen is this is going to grow and expand very powerfully. There's a number of very interesting aspects that arise from this to do with what we call euro dollar creation, the euro dollar multiplier, euro dollar leakage, and then also the nature of the euro dollar claim, and then euro dollar property. Now, what I've done is this: I've mentioned in here the background to the development of the markets, principally through the establishment of the SWIFT system. SWIFT is the Society for Worldwide Interbank Financial Telecommunication that was originally set up by, it was a gentleman called Carl Reuters-Rield. In 1973, it brought together, you'll see in the text, 518 banks from 22 countries to create a new messaging service. The problem simply was, before that, international payments were dealt with through one New York bank called the First National Bank of New York, FNCB. But a lot of other institutions and countries were concerned that one American bank was managing the international payment system, the International Payment Service. So they wanted to create an alternative, cooperative, collective model to manage this. So they established the SWIFT system in 1973. Most of the large value payments in the world go through SWIFT. As I said, originally 518 banks from 22 countries. This operates through what we call a BICS system, BICS, or the SWIFT codes. That's bank identity codes, as well as IBANs. our international bank account numbers. Essentially what happens is this, in the SWIFT system, if you want to move 100 million or $1 billion from London to New York or New York back to London, how do you do it? You send it through the system. You send it through SWIFT. But what actually moves it? Does $1 billion actually transfer through the SWIFT system? No. Why not? Because all SWIFT is a secure messaging system. That's all it is, a secure messaging network. All the banks in the world are connected through SWIFT, so they can agree the transfer of funds between themselves, essentially by adjusting account balances. So if you want to move $1 billion, all that happens is the bank in London says, I will debit this account by this account holder. The BIC is my account identifier and the bank. This is the account through the IBAN, so the BIC and the IBAN together. We can then identify the account. I will debit this account by a value of $1 billion if you credit this other account in New York by the equivalent amount. So what actually moved it? Nothing. Nothing moves. Every day, massive amounts of money are moved around the world through bank accounts. But what's actually in the bank account? Nothing. Nothing. All a bank is a claim by the account holder against the bank for a transfer of value. And usually when you go to the bank and you ask for, I've got $100 or $1 million, what the bank will normally do is just transfer that to another bank for you, exactly as I've explained. Nothing actually moves. Now, there's some two cases I'm going to mention in a couple of minutes, but let me just mention some other points first. Euro dollar creation. What actually happened was this. Massive amounts of money are then moved from the 1960s, the 1970s, from America to London. We get what we call euro dollar creation. What would happen is this. One bank moves funds from its account in New York to its own branch in London. It then relends that to another bank in London. That bank in London will relend it to the bank next door, and then the bank next door. If you go into the city of London, almost every building will have a bank. And very often the banks are right beside each other, because as I've said, at one point there was 532 of them. So what happens if you've moved, let's say, $100 million from New York to London, and then 10 banks have relent that money? What happens to the total money supply? What is the total money supply after 1 week, after 10 banks have lent each other $100 million? No. It's multiplied by a factor of 10. The total money supply, because each bank's now holding that balance, is lent to on. So this is the money creation. Within the euro-dollar system, you get this massive multiplication effect as the banks relend these funds to each other. That's the money creation. But we also have what we call that's the money creation, and then the money multiplier is that multiple figure. It might be 10 times, 100 times the original value. So 100 million becomes a billion, and then 10 billion, and then 100 billion in this system. However, some of the funds can leave, and we call that leakage. So you have euro-dollar leakage. Now, what's leakage? That's when, instead of the banks lending the money to each other in the euro-dollar interbank market, it's lent out to a borrower. So usually at some point, the banks will lend outside the system, so therefore you have leakage, and that multiplier and creation, those two effects stop. The other way it happens is that if banks hold a reserve, so one bank might say, well, I'm going to keep a 10% reserve or a 5% reserve, and I'll lend the other 90% or 95%. So you also get leakage through reserve management. That might be for regulatory purposes, and it might be for liquidity management purposes. So you get leakage through reserve retention as well as through lending outside the system. Now, let's talk about two interesting cases. What's actually in a bank account? Answer, nothing. Can you steal a bank account? No, why not?
Yes.
Because there's nothing inside the account to steal. Now, this was actually confirmed by the House of Lords in London in R versus Priddy, Slade and Dillon. This is 1986, Appeal Cases 816. R versus Priddy, 1996, Appeal Cases
816. This went all the way up to the House of Lords. The question was, can you steal funds under the Theft Act 1968? The Theft Act 1968, section 15.1, refers to obtaining property by deception belonging to another. The question simply is this. If you steal money from a bank account, are you obtaining property by deception which belongs to another? And this went all the way up to the House of Lords, and they concluded, no, you cannot, because there is nothing in the account. It's only a claim for payment by the account holder against the bank. Property was very widely defined to include money, any other assets, real or personal property of any form, including all manner of claims. So a claim is certainly property, but the question is, are you stealing something belonging to another? The answer is no, so therefore you cannot steal money in a bank account. What actually had to happen, the Law Commission looked at this, and then we had statutory amendment under what was called the Theft Amendment Act 1996. They had to create a series of new offences to cover stealing of funds from bank accounts. So under sections 1, 2 and 4, we now have an offence of obtaining money transferred by deception, credit from dishonest sources, or obtaining funds by deception, because you cannot steal the funds in the bank account. Now, let me ask another question. If you ask for the bank to repay the balance on the account, can you insist on cash, or can the bank transfer the money by value at its discretion? Can you insist on cash payment? For example, if you have 100 million or 200 million in the bank account, can you ask for that to be paid in cash?
No.
Answer, yes. This was Libyan Arab Foreign Banks versus Bankers Trust, 1986. It was reported 1989, Queen's Bench, QB 728. This was Lord Justice Stoughton. What had happened in that case was, there was a freeze of American assets issued by President Reagan, which prohibited American banks, including Bankers Trust, from paying to Libyan Arab Foreign Bank because of the sanctions against the Libyan government at that time. Bankers Trust was holding $131 million in New York and $161 million in London as Eurodollar payments in the Eurodollar system. The question was, did the bank have to pay if the bank account holder asked for those funds, even with American sanctions in place? And the court had to conclude, yes, the bank had to pay. And it was actually noted during the course of the judgment that if the account customer had insisted on payment in cash, the bank would have to have had paid out all of that money in cash. The total award in the end was $320.1 million. Now, what actually had to happen in that case was, you had a conflict. You had sanctions maintained by the American government. This prohibited American banks from transferring funds, but a commercial court judge in London had issued an award of $321 million against a New York bank. What did the American authorities do? To save face, they actually granted a special license in that case to allow Bankers Trust to pay the funds. Even if there are sanctions in place, governments cannot prohibit the payment of funds by private banks in these markets. But second important point was the fact that if a bank insists on payment, a customer insisted on payment in cash, they could ask for that. Now what I've done is this, there were some famous, interesting articles which looked at the nature of the Eurodollar system into the background of the system. It was a very important piece by Milton Friedman, who's a famous American economist, called The Eurodollar Market, Some First Principles. This was quite infamous. A lot of people used to read this and comment on this. People were trying to work out what was the nature of this system, what was the nature of the market. Basically, very simply, from a core legal analysis, forgetting all the economics, it's simply a claim. It's a claim to transfer value, and if you look at it in those terms, it's very simple indeed. And I summarise, I explain that at the top of the next page.
What happened was the economists tended to get into a lot of difficulty. And a lot of economists wrote a large number of papers on this, and much of it bordered on the nonsense, the meaningless. Where did this money come from? Was it money? What was the nature of this? Because they didn't consider it from a legal perspective. Now, strictly speaking, is a bank account money? Well, let me ask two questions. What is the value of all the banknotes and specie in the world? If you add up all the banknotes and specie in the world, what does that come to today? Total, $5.8 trillion. There are $5.8 trillion banknotes and coins in the world. But what's the value of all the bank accounts in the world?
That's what I'm if you going add to up. Ask you, because if you can request for any amount to be paid in cash by the bank, then isn't it mighty inconvenient, because there's a lot more money than there is cash?
The customer can insist on payment in cash, and the bank has to make that available if that's what's done. That would have had to happen in the Libyan foreign assets case. The point I'm making is this. There's only $5.8 trillion of banknotes and specie in the world. There are $90.4 trillion of bank accounts. All of the economic textbooks in the world talk about the value of M0 or M1 or M2, the total amount of money, as being around $100 trillion. From a legal perspective, is that true? Answer, no. Because most money isn't money. Most money is simply a claim for transfer of value. It's a claim for payment, which isn't money. An economist will tell you it's money, and most of the economics books say it's money. And this was the key difficulty behind all of the writing that was published on the nature of these euro-dollar markets and this euro-dollar system. Economists don't make, in my opinion, the necessary clear distinctions between what is an asset, what's not an asset, what's a claim, and what actually is money. There's another famous paper by Klopstock. I've mentioned that here as well. Fred H. Klopstock, Money Creation in the Eurodollar Market. This was kind of a riposte to the earlier Friedman paper. What you'll see in here is that people simply talked about money was a creation of a bookkeeper's pen. That was a famous quote from Friedman. Just a bookkeeper's pen. Banks create money from nothing. Again, very significant difficulties arise with this. Banks create loans, they can create debt, but is that money? Again, there's another famous paper. It's not referred to in this, but I'll give you the reference. It was a Bank of England paper. It was Michael McLeavy, Radia, and Ryland Thomas. The reference is Quarterly Bulletin, 2014-27. This is an important, significant paper. QB, Bank of England QB's Quarterly Bulletin, 2014-27. And it's basically about money creation. QB, 2014-27. You Google it, you'll find it immediately. It's a significant paper on the nature of money creation. And it basically restates all of these earlier assumptions that economists make about money. Basically, money's created because banks lend money, and the act of lending itself creates deposits, which creates more money. The question is, legally, is that correct? And then you'll see in the references here, there's the reference to the bookkeeper's pen. Money's, the eurodollar market is simply a bookkeeper's pen. Banks can create money out of nothing. This is what a lot of economists actually write. It's in a lot of the leading textbooks in this area, which I find absurd. And again, bookkeeper's pen further down there. The whole point simply is this. Banks create claims. They create debt. It's not money as such. It's only claims for transfer of value between persons. Is that property? Well, that depends how you extend the definition of property. If it's a physical asset, it's not property, but you can extend property to include claims as well, which most legal systems actually do, including under insolvency law. This causes a lot of difficulty in practice. The implication in this Bank of England paper, as was effectively restated by Friedman but corrected by Klopstock, is essentially that banks can create unlimited amounts of money just by creating ledger entries on their accounts, either physical pen or now electronically. That is simply wrong in law. It's wrong in practice. Why is it wrong in practice? Banks are subject to significant limitations, in particular through basic regulatory conditions called capital adequacy and simple insolvency law. Now, what actually happened was I had to read this Bank of England paper a large number of times. The first 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 pages all continue this myth that banks can create money from nothing and on an unlimited basis. Towards the end, they effectively slip in, admit that there are practical limitations, which is what, as a lawyer, I would look at first. Regulatory requirements and just simple insolvency means that banks have to have enough cover for all of their assets and liabilities. Simple double balance, double entry balance sheet. Your assets have to manage your liabilities. What are your assets? Your assets are your loans. That's your lending book, your loan book. What are your liabilities? That's your deposits, because they have to be repaid. If you've only got a small deposit base, let's say your loan book is 100 million, you've only got 20, 30, 40 million in loans. You can borrow then maybe another, let's say 40 million on interbank, or not interbank, but a sort of other wholesale lending. At the end of the day, you are 10 million or 20 million short. The implication is, from all of these economics books, that's not a problem. Banks can create money through lending, and that's of itself sufficient. That's completely wrong. The bank is technically insolvent and has to close down, and if the directors continue in business, they can be fined, and there's criminal penalties you can actually attach to that, because they're trading on a fraudulent basis. The point simply is this. In practice, what will happen is this. If a bank has a deposit base of 40, let's say 45 million, it's got 45 million wholesale lending, that's 90 million. If it's got a 10%, 10 million shortfall at the end of the day, what does the bank do? It has to go into the interbank market and top that 10 million up to stay solvent. If it's not solvent, it has to close down immediately. And all of the economist books ignore these things. Regulatory capital also means that you have to hold the international standard was 8% minimum. You have to hold 8% minimum capital against your total lending. So therefore, capital again acts as a very important, significant constraint. Banks cannot simply create money out of nothing. They cannot simply lend, and that's money creation by itself. 2 points, that's not money, and that's not created anyway. It's only a debt, it's claim. So economics textbooks get into a lot of difficulty with this, but if we look at it from a legal perspective, we can understand all of this and we can reduce it to very clear, simple points and arguments, which I attempt to do in the paper. The rest of the paper then looks at the key markets. We've got the euro loan market, we've got the euro bond market, we've also then got the euro notes and commercial paper market. The subsequent history of the market is this. Effectively, what happened was we're going to create euro loans. Let's say a company or a country wants to borrow 100 million. It goes into the market, it finds 10 banks to lend 10 million each, so that's your 10 bank syndicate going to lend 100 million. Alternatively, what the company can do is it can go into the bond market and it can issue security in the form of a bond. So you can also lend $100 million worth of bonds. So this all starts again with the beginning of the Eurodollar market, the beginning of the 1960s. The first Eurobond issue was the Otto Strade deal, 1963, with S.G. Warburg in London. It was 5.5% to raise $500 million to build what? To build the motorway system in North Italy. That's how the Italians built their motorways. The first Eurobond issue. And on the system, I'll show you certificates. That's part, this one. I've got copies of the certificates and some of the documentation that was issued. It was very interesting indeed. This is the first bond issue. So what you have is this. You borrow 100 million either from a syndicate of banks or through a 100 billion issue in the bond market. Initially, they were for the same duration. Usually 20 years fixed interest. The first bond was 5.5%. It was actually a $500 million deal. The subsequent history of the markets is this. Instead of issuing long fixed bonds, we're going to issue shorter notes which are not fixed but revolve. Instead of having fixed rate, which most of the lending was done in the 60s, by the time we get into the 70s, because of the collapse of Bretton Woods, foreign currency fluctuations, interest rate fluctuations, banks don't want to lend fixed, they want to lend floating. So we move from fixed bonds to floating notes. And then those notes become shorter and shorter and shorter. We go from long 20-year bond notes, the same as the bond, down to 15, 5, 10, 5, down to 1. You have 1-year notes. If you go less than 1 year, that's called commercial paper. So the history of the capital markets is constructing a parallel system to lend equivalent amounts of money as in the syndicated lending market, the banking market, except in the capital markets, we go from fixed to floating notes, and then the notes get shorter in duration. You can have long bonds, let's say 30, 20 years. You can have up to 50-year bonds. You can even have unlimited bonds. International financial institutions such as the World Bank, regional development banks, they may still issue 50-year bonds. Most people will only ever issue 20-year bonds, maybe up to 30. But more modern practice is now shorter notes. People don't lend 20 years, they're going to lend 15, 10, 5, and now even less than 1 year becomes commercial paper. Commercial paper can be 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, down to 1 month, 30 days, or even 5 days. And if it's overnight, then you're back into the interbank markets. That is the history of the capital markets. That's the history of the euro-dollar system. So euro notes are short notes. The difference between a note and a bond is that the note is floating, the bond is fixed, and then the commercial paper is debt under 1 year. Then we have the financial derivatives markets. I explained the background to the growth in the market. We go from the early instruments, which were designed to manage risk in the early 1970s. We had the collapse of the Bretton Woods system, with floating currencies, interest rates from 1971 onwards. This is formally accepted in 1973. They originally had a committee of 20 to try and manage this system, but that failed. So we're on floating currencies, floating interest rates from 1973. This is formally recognised by the International Monetary Fund, 1976, at the Jamaica meeting, with amendments made to the Articles of Association of the IMF. That's the beginning of the new world that we live in. Because of all of this new risk, we have to create new instruments to manage that. What are the new instruments? Financial derivatives. We have futures, options and swaps. A future is an obligation to buy or sell at a future fixed time amount price. Obligation, future, fixed time amount price. An option is the right to buy or sell at a future fixed time price and amount. And a swap is any exchange of obligations. You can have currency swaps, commodity swaps, interest rate swaps. Now, almost anything you can imagine, you can swap. The key documentation in this area is prepared by the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, ISDA. The key documentation in the capital market area, the bond, the notes and commercial paper, is prepared by the International Capital Market Association, ICMA. And we've already mentioned the key documentation in the loan area, the syndicated lending, is by the Loan Market Association. All of that is covered and summarised in this paper.